This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with soon-to-be 94-year-old Del Blomquist of Tulare, California. He was hoping to become a pilot in World War II, but when enlistments for that program were cut off, he outraced the draft by joining the Navy. 17-year-olds could enlist in the Navy or Marines at that point if their parents signed. His did, and Del ended up spending more than 2 years on the USS Ganymede, a cargo ship in the Pacific.
And you told me the story of when you got on the Ganymede and you asked immediately to be transferred to an aircraft carrier so you could fly. Does that mean that you weren't too thrilled with that assignment to a cargo ship?
Well, it was a strange thing for me, and I thought that flying would be more interesting. But after I got into the swing of things on that cargo ship, the duty was okay. And the deck force, you're chipping a lot of paint and fixing things. And the cargo ship has got a lot of things to fix, booms, and you learn how to run winches and load cargo and all of that stuff. So it became a kind of interesting life, sometimes boring because you'd be laying at anchor someplace up in New Guinea for 3 months or 9 months or whatever. But it was an okay job, and I went from seaman second to bosun's mate second on that ship in the 28 months I was on it. So the bosun mate is the guy that runs the crew that maintains the ship, does the chipping of paint and putting on new paint and fixing all those things. So I became the boss. It was enjoyable.
And I believe you still have the whistle to prove it, don't you?
Yes, I do. I still have the bosun's pipe.
How often do you blow on that and make a little noise?
Well, we have these veterans affairs at the high schools around Tulare. There's all four high schools. They trade off every year. And we take our uniforms. I take my uniform and my bosun's pipe. And once in a while, I give a few tweets. And some of the other veterans are, "Oh, hey, boats, how you doing?"
They know that familiar sound.
Yep.
All right, so I was going to ask you your duties aboard the ship, and you just gave me a little taste of that. What about those rare occasions where it's a general quarters situation? Where would you have to go in that instance?
When I became a bosun's mate second, my general quarters station was on the bridge to carry out the orders of the commanding officer of the ship, make sure people are on their station and all of that. Before that, when I was a seaman, I just stood watch up in the bow of the gun tub or something like that. But after becoming a petty officer, I wound up on the bridge during general quarters. Yeah.
Where all did you guys go? What kind of cargo were you transporting? And what was that like?
Well, the most interesting part of the assignment was with USS Ganymede and four of our sister ships. They were all brand new cargo ships made on old Liberty ship hulls, brand new Liberty ship hulls. And they had a towing winch astern to tow things. So when I went aboard that ship, there were all five ships were at anchor off Tiburon in San Francisco Bay. We were going to leave the next morning. This is August the 28th, 1943. Here comes five tugs, each one towing a section of a floating dry dock. A floating dry dock is a big, immense thing that's put together in sections. 10 sections you can float a battleship or an aircraft carrier. Well, we're five ships, and they gave us each one a floating dry dock to tow from San Francisco to Espiritu Santos in New Hebrides Islands, which is about 6,000 or 7,000 miles away. And the speed of the convoy was 5 knots. That's 6 miles an hour. But we didn't get sunk or anything like that. We made it to New Hebrides.
Well, I haven't done the math in my head, but that had to take you quite a while at that pace.
Yeah, it was the New Hebrides islands are down kind of west of Guadalcanal and north of Australia. And like you say, it's about 6,500, 7,000 miles from San Francisco to there. 50 days, we didn't see any land. 52 days, we got to Espiritu Santos and got the dry dock delivered. And then we headed for Melbourne, Australia, and the speed of the ship went up 100%. And I thought, this thing is flying.
Well, I know you can laugh about it now, but I'm just wondering, at the time, did you feel vulnerable? going that slowly without a lot of defenses?
Oh, sure. Sure. We stood watch, of course, looking for airplanes and submarines, and lucky we didn't see any. But we were just a sitting duck, you might say, out there in the Pacific waiting for somebody to put a torpedo at us. But it didn't happen. Fortunately, we made it.
Well, in 52 days, and you don't see land for almost all of that for 50 days, what about your supplies? Did you still have enough to eat by the time you got there?
Well, you might call it something to eat. Usually in about 4 weeks, we would be out of good food. We'd be down to, these potatoes and stuff that are dehydrated. And eggs begin to have a little taste that wasn't normal. But we got by, stayed healthy, but we did not have a lot of good, solid, fresh food all the way. There is a little story to go with that. After I was out there for a while, we were anchored in the Admiralty Islands off the coast of New Guinea, and my mom was always good about sending me a letter, she'd keep track of where some of my friends were located. And I had a friend named Forrest Ogan who was on the USS Mizar, which was a refrigeration ship. And I saw it coming into port in the Admiralty Islands, and I immediately went up and got on the light, and I asked them if they had Seaman Ogan aboard, and they came back and said, positive, yes. So I got a boat, and I went over there when they got anchored, and I went aboard, and they took me down to where my friend was working, and he was working in the galley. He was standing between two of those big tubs on wheels, picking the stems out of fresh strawberries. So I joined in, two for me and one for them. Then he says, hey, you want some ice cream? I said, oh, yeah, of course. So I made up my mind then if I ever had a chance to volunteer on sea duty, I would go to a refrigeration ship.
You'll always be well fed. I guess I have to ask, though, did you take anything back for any of your shipmates?
From the Mizar? Oh, no. I didn't do that. It was all fresh.
It wouldn't have kept, yeah. And did you tell any of those guys back on your ship
I told them that the Mizar is loaded with good food. That's where I'm going if I ever get a chance.
The things we can take for granted. I guess I didn't ask you about the complement of your ship. How many men aboard that crew on the Ganymede?
We had somewhere around approximately 135, 140 crew. It's a comfortable ship, a good commanding officer. I think he was a merchant marine captain, and they just brought him into the Navy and made him a Navy commander, and he was a good man, and so we didn't have anything to complain about with him. He was just wonderful. Yeah, just settle down to, routine, and you just sometimes you're really bored because you're just hankered someplace, not doing much. Other times you get excited.
And I imagine when you spend that much time with those guys, you probably get to know the rest of the crew pretty well.
Oh, yes, yeah. You get to know everybody and make friendships that last forever. Yeah, the camaraderie is great.
Well, I'm sure not everything was great. And you've told us some of the challenges that you guys faced just by being at sea that long. I want to hear about some times where the enemy made you a little nervous, but also I'm curious if the weather ever gave you any concern. Did you guys have to sail through some typhoons or some of that rough stuff?
Yes, the ship that I was on, a Liberty ship hull, had a problem in the early days of the building. It was cracking in two pieces. But the Navy requirements for that ship had a big steel band around it, which beefed it up. We thought we didn't have to worry about that. And one time I was in the shower, and we were in heavy seas, and the bow would go way up like this, and then it would come back down. And one time it came down on top of another wave, and that ship just shuddered. I said, oh, my God, that's going to go. But it hung together. So that made me feel a lot better after that because it was really bad, heavy, rough seas. The other thing is we were involved in the invasion of Hollandia, New Guinea. Hollandia, New Guinea had an air base. Our job was to take Army Air Corps field engineers. We had a whole bunch of gear and trucks and stuff and people on the ship, and we took them into Tanimera Bay, which is right near Hollandia. And we unloaded them, put them ashore, and they went through the jungle, had a couple of firefights we could tell as they hit the jungle. But they moved all that stuff up and went to the air base, Hollandia Air Base, and fixed all the bomb craters we made so we could use it. And after 2 or 3 days of unloading those people, we were ready to leave at night. We headed out to sea and headed south, and pretty quick we could hear an airplane orbiting overhead. The next thing that happened was about 50 bright flares lit up overhead, and it was just like daylight. And the airplane orbited us for another couple of three times, and they could see that we had nothing on our decks and we were high on the water, so they flew back. They left us alone, because I thought for sure the next thing was going to happen after the flares was a bomb. But they went back to Hollandia and caught our sister ship moving from one place to another with stuff still on her deck, and they put an aerial torpedo in her fantail, that's a stern, and it destroyed the rudder. It didn't work, so they couldn't steer it. And they put a hole, the torpedo put a hole in the number 5 hold of the ship, and it sunk stern first in the shallow water. And the sailors got all the watertight doors closed so that the ship was saved. But they finally put a patch on it and pumped the water out of number 5 hole and got it on even keel. And they were able to put it in dry dock and fix the rudder and fix everything that so it could be operated, except they couldn't get a screw shaft. So they had no way of propulsion. So what they did then was just assign a tug to that ship for the rest of the war. It was towed every place it went.
And you thought your journey from San Francisco to Espirito Santo was a long trip or a slow trip.
Yeah, very slow.
You think they were slower when they were getting tugged everywhere?
Probably. They were used to it. Because it was one of our sister ships that made the trip.
Yeah. Well, not too many people have been in that situation. You're aboard this ship. The plane is orbiting overhead, as you said. One bomb can ruin all you guys. This isn't a heavily fortified ship by any means. So what's going through your mind as you're looking up at that plane and wondering when the bomb's going to fall?
I was frightened. Naturally. Yeah, I just knew it was going to happen, that there wasn't anything I could do about it. So you just have to go through it. That's all you can do.
Maybe it's hard to remember, too, but was the ship quiet? Was there panic, chaos? How would you describe the atmosphere on the ship?
Everybody was at general quarters and standing by their guns and waiting for something to happen, which it didn't, and we were very happy about that.
And it's probably too high for anybody to try to shoot it down?
Yeah. Well, the ship that I was on didn't have what you'd call good gunnery accuracy. We were more or less shooting it. You're on your own, you know. So I don't know. They did not give us the order to fire at the airplane because they figured maybe they'd give them a better target or something. So we didn't fire at it.
And that's a situation I want to explore a little further when we come back. Del Blomquist of Tulare, California, our guest today. Check out the photos of Del and a short video of him relaying that close call you just heard about to the Tulare Rotary Club at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.